following is a recording of a sermon given at All Saints Lutheran Church in Ottawa, Canada. For additional messages and more information, visit allsaintslutheran.ca. This is Pastor Alan Gilman. Several minutes into the following sermon, I played a video of Max MacLean's performance of the reading of the first chapter of Mark's Gospel. For copyright reasons, I've not included it here, but you can access the entire performance on a YouTube playlist via the link tinyurl.com/markgospeldrama. That's one word. Again, that's tinyurl.com/markgospeldrama. All lowercase, all one word. Even better, you can rent it or purchase it at vimeo.com/on-demand, lowercase one word, / Mark's Gospel, lowercase one word. Again, you can rent it or purchase it at vimeo.com/on-demand/Mark's Gospel.
Well, with a new year, I'm starting a new series that I call The Remarkable Gospel. We're going to be looking at the Gospel of Mark for the foreseeable future. And why am I calling it the Remarkable Gospel, apart from the obvious little built-in pun? It's because there's a lot of reaction in Mark's version of the story of Jesus. And often we'll see how people marvel or are astounded by what's going on in the story. And it seems that the story as Mark brings it to us is actually designed that way. Now, for casual readers of the Bible, when you get to the New Testament, you start off with those books that we call the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And when you read Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you get the impression, oh, they're just retelling a lot of the same stories. And scholars, too, have noticed that, and that's why Matthew, Mark, and Luke are called the Synoptic Gospels. Synoptic means seeing together, and it has to do with this perceived similarity of perspective that these three Gospels appear to have. And because of that, scholars get really excited about this sort of thing, and over time, they've began to postulate, well, which one was written first, and which ones were using other ones to get some of their material from. You know, it seems that they say that Mark was written first, and so it's possible that Matthew and Luke used some of Mark when they wrote their Gospels. And really, we don't know how any of this actually worked. There is a tradition that Mark's version of the story of Jesus came from Peter. Mark was not an eyewitness to much of the story, but Peter was, and it looks like Mark was a traveling companion with the Apostle Peter, and it's likely that Mark put into writing what he heard Peter tell. It's even possible that Peter would have told the story of Jesus in some occasions exactly the way that Mark eventually wrote it down. As I said, to the casual reader, it almost looks like Matthew and Luke just borrow stories from Mark, but that's, if you look really closely, that doesn't really seem to be the case. Mark is the shortest of all four Gospels, by quite a bit, for those of you that like statistics. The book of Luke in Greek has 19,482 words. Matthew comes in second with 18,345 words. How come you're not writing this down? Oh, I know, because you can listen to the recording later. That makes sense. John comes in third at 15,635 words, and Mark is only a very short 11,304 words. And yet, even though it's the shortest, sometimes his telling of some of the episodes in Jesus' life and teaching actually have more detail than the versions we find of the same stories in the other Gospels. I don't have the verse reference right here, but in Matthew and or Luke, they talk about the people sitting down on the grass. And in Mark, it's they sit down on the green grass. And something I like to remind people is, unlike what we have today, now a lot of writing today doesn't even appear on paper at all. It's all digital. And it's very, very cheap to write. In the when we had to rely on paper, paper eventually, for us, became very cheap. So you can write and write and write. I believe one of the reasons why people like Dickens wrote very long novels, originally they were written in magazines and newspapers, and then I believe then they were compiled in a book version. It's something like that. But they got paid by the word. So the more you wrote, the more money you made. So it was, so no wonder the stories tend to be very, lots and lots of description and lots of words, lots and lots of pages. But the Bible books are written in a very, very concise manner. So to write green grass must have meant something. And it seems to reflect a version of the story that's told by an actual eyewitness. So as I said, while Mark was likely not there for most of these stories, Peter was. And Mark seems to be providing us with what Peter actually, not only what Peter saw, but how Peter told the story. Not only is there more detail in some of the stories that he tells, we get some psychological insights, what people were thinking and feeling. There's also this great sense of suspense in the Gospel of Mark. It's likely that the story was told from beginning to end. In those days, especially in the, as far as we could tell, the Gospel of Mark is written to a Greek-Roman audience as opposed to a Jewish one. It's very rooted in Jewish understanding of life and of truth, but the presentation was for a non-Jewish audience. And depending where people lived, they only had about a 10 to 20% literacy rate, which is an 80 to 90% illiteracy rate. That's all to say, most people didn't read. Most people didn't read books. Most people didn't read anything. The stories that they heard and knew all came orally. And the Gospel of Mark comes across as, the way it's written, is as if it's the writing down of an oral telling of the story. And the story's told in a way, as I mentioned earlier, it's to evoke response from the hearers. That's why we get a lot of this kind of people remarking on what's going on. They're astounded, they're amazed. The reader is meant to feel that way. And so, actually, the gospel, in the way it was written, was meant to be read aloud. Now, I know we read scripture here. I do so every week. And it's good to hear the scripture read aloud, especially since it was meant to be read aloud. But with no comment on our current reader today, nothing in that, I wonder if we are reading with the tone, with the drama, that the original hearers of this book would have heard it. Now, what I'm going to show you next, I'm not saying that this is the way that we should do it necessarily. I also don't necessarily agree with the dramatic interpretation of this particular reader's approach. But what I'm going to show you, I think, is going to help you, help draw you in a little more to the book. So what we're going to do in a moment is we're going to hear and see a dramatic reading of Mark chapter 1 by the actor Max MacLean. Max is a founder of a Christian performing arts group in New York City. And he's one of the common, if you ever listen to an audio Bible, Max MacLean is one of the main people that does this sort of thing. I didn't know that he had become somewhat famous for doing a one-man show of the reading of the Gospel of Mark. As far as I can tell, he's memorized the version of Mark from the New International Version. I'm pretty sure that's what he's got it from. And so we're not going to do all of Mark chapter 1 today. In fact, we're only going to do the first verse after we see this video. And you can see these videos chapter by chapter on YouTube. The version I'm sharing with you is I purchased it. It wasn't that expensive. It's legal. For those of you that are concerned about copyright, it's legal to be showing this to you. And so let's see how Max MacLean interprets Mark chapter 1. So depending how it goes, we might come back and watch and listen to Max MacLean's rendition of Mark. It'll be a little while before we get to Mark chapter 2. And again, if you're interested, you can go online and look him up, and you could watch that again. Just before I go on to the first verse of the chapter, we're even showing these things. It's in chapters, but as you know, or maybe it's news to you, the Bible was not written in chapters. They were all added later, much, much later. And I can't remember I think it's the 12th century that the chapters, somebody added chapters to the Bible books. And so the breaks in the books, most of them, except for books like the Psalms that have more natural beginnings and ends, the breaks in the Bible books that we call chapters, as well as the verses are even later. So the chapter breaks were added much, much later. So somebody's deciding when we pause and then continue to the next chapter. Okay, so the gospel, according to Mark, begins with the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. That's how it's translated in the New Revised Standard Version, in many versions, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Now, we call these books the gospels, the four gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the four gospels. Calling them that is actually, that's a genre. It's like a type of book. We have Paul's letters and the other letters in the New Testament. And then we have the Gospels. So we're referring to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as a certain type of writing, the Gospels. But that way of thinking of these four books, that way of thinking of this kind of writing is a way people thought about it much later. What we really have here in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are are stories of Jesus. And Mark introduces his version of the story of Jesus with these words, the beginning of the gospel or the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. One of my talks, or more than once, I've explained this before, this term gospel, which means good news, euangelion in Greek, was actually a technical term in the Roman Empire of Mark's day. A euangelion was a royal proclamation. It wasn't just good news. Well, I got good news. You know, like we said, I got some good news and bad news. What do you want to hear first? That's not what the term meant, especially in a context like this. A euangelion was normally a proclamation about the emperor. Could be a birthday, could be the telling of a military victory. That's what a euangelion was. So when Mark writes the beginning of the euangelion of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, it's very difficult for us to translate that into English. If we say gospel, which is how it's been translated into English for centuries, then it sounds like this is Mark's gospel, not Matthew's gospel, not Luke's gospel, not John's gospel. Here's Mark's gospel. I'm going to tell you a gospel story. Gospel becomes code for the story about Jesus coming, teaching, doing miracles, dying for our sins, and rising from the dead. That's a gospel. But that's not what it would have meant for the hearers who heard this story in their day. They didn't know about gospel music. That comes way later. That's, again, if I refer to gospel music, we call that's a technical term. It's a certain style. It's not just because there's Christian music. There's contemporary Christian music that some here in this room either like or don't like. But if I refer to gospel music, that's a certain style. It has a certain kind of content, and it has a musical style to it, as opposed to country music or classical music. So when Mark speaks about the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, he means something very, very particular. And that particularity of the term Evangelion, gospel, good news, is underscored by what the proclamation, what the Evangelion is about. Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Now, when we hear Jesus Christ, we think of that as his whole name. Some people might think it's disrespectful to just refer to Jesus. I once heard a sermon many years ago where this preacher insisted that the only honorable way to refer to him was the Lord Jesus Christ. My problem with that is that's not the way he's referred to in the Bible. And I thought the Bible's our authority. So I don't have a problem with saying Jesus, just like I don't have a problem with saying Paul or James or Peter, because the titles were added later. We could discuss that at another time if that matters to you. We could talk about that more. But many of us, when we read the good news or the gospel, the Evangelion of Jesus Christ, it's like, here he's giving us his whole name. So as if somebody would introduce me as Alan Gilman, as opposed to simply Alan. Alan Gilman being my whole name. I don't have a middle name. You probably didn't know that. You do now. So Alan Gilman is my whole name, as opposed to just my first name, or just my surname or last name. Now I know nobody thinks that Christ is Jesus' surname as if his parents were Mr. and Mrs. Christ. I know that maybe there are some people that think that, but nobody who goes to church for any length of time, has read the New Testament at all, would think that. But at the same time, I do get the impression, and I know this for a fact, because I've asked people, what does Christ mean? And I often have gotten the answer. And to be fair, I believe it's mainly from children, but children who know the Bible pretty well. If I ask them, what does Christ mean? The answer is Jesus. Which means, so Christ becomes synonymous with, and which is the same way we do, like in some circles, I might be called Gilman. Hey, Gilman. So I could be called Alan. I could be called Gilman. I might be called Al, which happens a lot more in Ontario than other parts of Canada. But it's all the same person. And so Christ is often used in the same way, like a surname. You know, there are surnames that have derived in the form of, you know, son of somebody. I believe that's true in, we have that in some Scandinavian languages, like right? So we have the Edmondson, you know, these sorts of names. We have bar or ben someone in Aramaic and Hebrew, son of. And these names become not so much reminiscent about who the original father was, but it becomes the surname, the family name of that person. I knew somebody, his last name was Taylor. Last name was Taylor. Probably he had an ancestor that was a Taylor. And that became known as the surname, the family name of that person. And so when people hear Jesus Christ, they take it as some sort of surname. But it isn't. Christ is a title. And in English, the way English translations have come to us, by the way it's given to us, Jesus Christ, we lose the fact that it's a title. It sounds like his full name. The original hearers would not hear it that way. As many of you know, Christ is the Greek word Christos. That's why there's a CH at the beginning, because we don't have a CH in English. So somebody decided to do CH to make it to represent CH. Greek, it's Christos. Christos means anointed one. Anointed one is the English of the Hebrew Mashiach. Gotta love those Chs. Mashiach. So when we want to represent Mashiach in an English form, we do Messiah. When we want to do Christos in an English form, we do Christ. But they mean anointed one. Goes back to the Old Testament. When a king or the high priest would be set apart for their duties, for their role, they would have oil poured, not placed, poured on their heads. And the anoint, and it wasn't not just oily, it was like a perfume. So the fragrance of it, and you know what it's like when somebody really perfumes themselves. I was at the NAC once, and this young man showed up, and you could almost see the cloud. It was incredible. And there's all these people around me, and some of them started choking. And it became a scene. And I don't know if, and I know for some of you it's a pet peeve, I don't know if it has to do with a person's, just their lack of sense of smell, but you know what it's, all I'm doing is trying to give, I'm not trying to trigger you. But my brother was once in an airplane where this lady sat down next to him, and it totally overtook every other sense. You know what I'm talking about. But that's what it was like to be anointed. It was a way, instead of wearing a sign, I am the anointed one, you would know by the fragrance that this person was set apart for this particular role. And by the time we get to this point in Jewish history, anointed one became a technical term not for any anointed one, a priest or a king, but for the long-awaited great king, the great son of David who would come and deliver the people. So they were waiting for Mashiach. They were waiting for Messiah. And so to be told that about Jesus Christ, it's Jesus the Messiah, which basically means king. He's the king. Jesus the king. And the hearers would know this. The beginning of the royal proclamation of King Jesus, the Son of God. Now, Christians hear Son of God, and we almost take it for granted. Jesus is the Son of God. Like, that's who he is, right? He's the Son of God. He's the Son of God. But in the first century, and especially in the Roman context, the emperor was the Son of God. The emperor was divine. Yangelion was reserved for the emperor. Hear ye, hear ye. You don't do that just for anybody. Stand up for his royal majesty, who has just returned from the battle. Hail the conquering hero. That's what a Yangelion would be. That's what a gospel would be. And Mark, and maybe this would be done, it might have been Peter, in a town square, and it would be as if he was standing up and was saying, hear ye, hear ye. It's so difficult to try to bridge the gap from a first century culture to a 21st century culture. A first century culture, a story told by some Jewish guys from Israel, probably now in the capital of the then greatest world power, this capital, Rome, to a non-Jewish audience. And now I'm trying to share this with you in the 21st century in Ottawa, Canada. And one of the things that struck me about Max McLean's rendition of it is when he acts out the crowd, what's this? Somebody teaching with authority? All of a sudden we're in rural England. But he's trying to, and he's probably, I think that's performed in New York City. It would be even better if you did it with a Brooklyn accent, maybe, rather than almost a Cockney accent. But how do you take people from here in Ottawa, us speaking English, and us coming from all sorts of different cultural backgrounds, and try to get us back and feel the oomph of what Peter, as written now by Mark, was proclaiming to a Roman audience? But I'm trying my best to take you back there. The beginning of the royal proclamation of King Jesus, Son of the Divine. Dem's fightin' words. This is not a nice church service on a Sunday morning. Dem's fightin' words. To actually say this in the Roman Empire of Mark's day, that's sedition. It's undermining Roman authority to tell a story like this. This is not, okay, children, let me tell you a nice Bible story. This is a proclamation that challenges the ruling authorities of that day. And while God didn't call the early believers to take up sword and shield to fight the Romans, this was dynamite that would eventually overthrow the Roman Empire from the inside as people were turning to the true king. This is why Isaiah 52 is so important that we read earlier. Because there we're told in Isaiah 52 verse 7 that the good news is proclaim to Zion, your God reigns. From the original Hebrew Jewish background to this, the proclamation of the coming of the Messiah is that the coming of the Messiah represents the return of God to Zion. The reign of God the King over Zion, which we learn in the Old Testament, it eventually spills over to the entire world, where what was lost in the Garden of Eden, when our first parents rebelled against God, is being restored by His Son, whereby He will rule over all the earth. And any emperor, king, prince, or boss, or church leader, or parent, anyone who in authority who seeks to usurp God by thinking that they can control people and that they're Lord over all, their days are numbered. God has established authority, kings, prime ministers, presidents, bosses, parents, and so on. Authority and the idea of having authority structure is of God and is godly, well, potentially godly, but needs to be submitted to God's kingship through His Son. And that is what is being proclaimed here. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The divine and rightful ruler has come. And then Mark begins to unpack for his listeners the qualifications of this king as he begins to tell the story. The next several verses, which we'll look at next week, read as a sort of prelude. They're very quick, very choppy, as a bridge to begin to unpack a story that seems to have one purpose, your response, as seen through the eyes and the reactions of the people who are responding one way or another to Jesus throughout the telling of the story. The Evangelion, the gospel, is a story, is a proclamation designed to respond to, not just listen to. And too many of us have only listened to this story for too long. We need to respond. The King has come, and He is the rightful ruler, and He has conquered death, and He invites us to be part of His mission on this earth to rescue the captors and proclaim the reign of the rightful King.
The following is a recording of a sermon given at All Saints Lutheran Church in Ottawa, Canada. For additional messages and more information, visit allsaintslutheran.ca.